It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll be talking about why Americans are most likely to turn on the TV when it comes to seeking out news, and what this says about the state of today's journalism.
But first, it's time for our nostalgia segment, where we take a look back at the people, places, and things from our past that we fondly remember.
We're joined today by Christy Taylor. She is one of the producers of The Joy Cardine Show, and she is nostalgic for both a place and a time.
Well, Christy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And this is our second nostalgia segment ever. Thank you so much for helping us keep the ball rolling. And I understand what you miss the most, maybe especially at this time of year, is a cabin from your childhood.
Yeah, this was actually my grandpa's cabin up in Door County on the edge of Sturgeon Bay. And and I didn't learn a lot of these things in, you know, when I was a kid. Mostly it was just, you know, we went up there, my mom, my dad, my brother and sister and me, and just ran around and saw my grandpa. And, you know, there was the lake right there and, well, the bay. And, you know, it was just, you know, summer fun times. But he actually built this himself in the 1960s, or rather he had his kids do a lot of the work. And, you know, they had like a contractor sort of supervise to make sure everyone was safe because everyone was in their teens or early 20s at that point. My mom would have been, I would say, you know, 14 or 15. And they built this cabin that he ended up retiring to after he retired just by hand. So it was a sort of family effort that ended up being sort of his last home.
That's something special, isn't it, about when something is built by hand, it means more, and especially when it's built by your own family. So not only was this cabin somewhere you went every summer to see your family, but they built it. That must have felt different.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like a place with a lot of love in it. It felt really homey. I mean, it was a really solid cabin, too. Like, I never would have guessed when I was a kid that it was sort of homemade, but, well, not homemade, you know, handmade, but it was solid, it was clean, it was, you know, well-built, it was a house, and it just felt warm all the time, I would say.
And there's something special about summer, the summer memories. I think they're often especially poignant because this is the time when we're not in school, we're not stressed, and summers seem so fleeting in Wisconsin because they are fleeting. And I don't know, do you think there's something special about summertime memories?
I mean, summer always felt like this time of freedom for me when I was a kid because, you know, school was out. So, you know, adventures could happen. You weren't bound by the clock in the same way. I was a nerd as a kid, and so I would read a lot during the summer, and I could read for fun, which I couldn't do during the school year. And so one of the things that I think made especially this place really nice was that I could just sort of run off and read and no one would bother me for long periods of time. There were like a lot of flat rocks right up against the water that would catch the sun really well. And I would just kind of like a lizard just sort of lie out there with a book on, you know, the rocks, and the sun would go down over the water. And it was just, it was a chance to see a lot of things that I wouldn't necessarily get to experience at home, too.
Well, you didn't only go up there in the summer. Sounds like a lot of the time that's your main cabin time. But there were some winter memories you have, too, right?
Oh, yeah. We went up in the winter a couple times. And those memories aren't as clear for me, and probably because they weren't as frequent. But I have, like, one really vivid memory of just this one day when we were up there in the winter, probably around, I would say, Christmas, and the snow had fallen so deep that, you know, it would have been up, I was short even then, but it would have been up to, like, you know, my waist, at least. And because it was so deep, like, our boots weren't going to be tall enough. So my mom just put bread bags on our feet, basically, all the way up our legs and under our snow pants, and and then put our boots on over that. And I remember just being, like, really excited that I was, like, running around in the snow. And my feet were completely dry, and I was, like, hip deep in this snow.
that sounds like a good memory.
So I felt like a sled dog or something like that.
So what happened to the cabin?
Well, my grandpa died when I was about 13, also in the summer. So actually, I guess my last summer memory of that cabin was his funeral. And I sat out on the rocks one last time, sort of afterwards, while everyone was milling around in the house and dealing with you know, being the relatives of the departed. I didn't want anything to do with that. So I, again, sort of sought solace there. But afterwards, it was sold, and I believe it was renovated quite a bit, like turned into sort of one of those sort of mansions on the water that they have up there. So I know I drove past. I actually went up there last summer, my first time back there since the funeral, I think, like as an adult, as you know, someone who has aged, you know, 15 years since then. And I couldn't find the exact spot. The approach, everything's covered by trees, and then you just have everything sort of on the other side of trees. So I was driving along Bayshore Drive, which is this very windy, woody road in Sturgeon Bay. And I just knew when I had passed it, because I knew that the shape of the road, and I knew, like, there's a certain inn on your right. And when I got there, I was like, oh, I passed it. And I felt kind of a loss, you know, just having, like, not being able to sort of revisit, because I knew if I turned around and, like, looked for it, I'd probably find it, but it would look really different anyway, so it didn't really matter. And I wouldn't be able to go poke around because it didn't belong to me anymore. So in that respect, that was sad.
Yes, it's kind of crazy, isn't it, when you think about how something could change that much in 15 years? I mean, I guess it's a lot of time, but in another sense, it's not that much time, and you sort of expect to be able to at least hold on to that place, that memory of where it was, maybe sit on the rocks one more time. That would have been nice.
It would have been, yeah.
Would you ever go up if you were able to pin down that house, knock on the door and say, you know what? I used to live here and I know the story of this place.
You know, I don't think so. Because, I mean, at the same time, it was still a place that belonged to my grandfather, who is, you know, this man in my life and who cannot be replaced. And so, you know, if there had been a way for the house to stay in the family, I think it would have been different. I think that, you know, we could have kept it our family's place, but because he was gone and because it was no longer ours, I don't think that it would really, I mean, I think having that memory be my last memory is, in many ways, a lot better than, you know, seeing how things have changed.
Yeah, and summer cabins, do you think now, you know, you're a young woman, you don't have children yet, but you may someday, do you think you might ever like to give them the experience you had of going back to a special place, maybe in Door County, maybe somewhere else that they could, you know, kind of bond with like you did?
I mean, I think if I'm not seeing myself as someone who will have children, but I think in general, having these places is an important thing for anybody in a lot of ways of any age. I mean, I think having I wouldn't say, I mean, refuge is a dramatic word, but a retreat, you know, I mean, having a place to go to enjoy those sort of simpler, less hassled and hurried aspects of life. And, you know, Door County is a beautiful place. Northern Wisconsin is a beautiful place. A lake in general is a beautiful place. And, you know, I think everybody should be able to discover that at some point in their life.
One nice thing about your story is that you got to say goodbye to the place before you left it. Lots of times in things we miss, things that we're nostalgic for, I've noticed this in my own life, you don't know when it's the last time. All of a sudden it's the last time and you never know and you never really get that closure. Are you glad that you had that moment on the rocks on that last day and you got to say kind of goodbye to the house and goodbye to your grandpa?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that was an important moment for me. I mean, I don't think, you know, sometimes ending without knowing it's goodbye can be better in some ways. You know, sadness can sort of cloud that actual experience and maybe make it harder to enjoy the moment. But at the same time, if you know it's goodbye, you can sort of take the appropriate steps. You can say, well, here's where I want to be for this, you know, last experience. And I got to do that, and I'm grateful for that.
Do you think your grandfather knew how much this cabin meant to you? Would he be surprised to hear what you're saying right now about this place?
I don't know that he knew. I mean, I'm sure he was glad to have us up. We came up every single summer, sometimes multiple times. You know, it was a really important tradition for us. And I know he knew that much. And I know he was glad to see us. And, you know, he would come down to Madison. And like, I know he treasured our relationship and our closeness as a family.
So he'd probably be unsurprised and happy to hear you bringing his cabin to life again.
I would hope he would be proud in some ways.
Well, Christy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you've got something you're nostalgic for, well, we'd love to hear from you. Give our Central Time hotline a call and leave us a message with your story. That toll-free number is 855-683-5422. And again, that's 855-683-5422. And make sure to leave us your contact information.
And again, thank you to Christy Taylor for sharing her nostalgia about her family cabin. Coming up next, we'll be talking about why TV trumps the internet when it comes to news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Jean Purcell. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. A new Gallup poll shows that TV is the main source of news for most Americans. We still turn to the television for news about current events, even with the increase in internet news sources. But the internet was still number two on that list. Newspapers or other print sources were third, and radio was ranked as the fourth most used news source.
So where do you get most of your news? Are you a fan of television news, or do you go somewhere else to get your daily news fix? Let us know at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@WPR.org.
Devon Shaw is here to break down this new poll and let us know what it says about our society. He's a professor of communication and political science at UW-Madison. Devon, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you.
So what do you think of these findings from this poll? Does this make sense with what the research you've done?
I think it does. There is still a very powerful broadcast, and broadcast to use broadly, television news culture in this country. It has declined, and we've seen shifts away from broadcast news towards more cable news sources, but local news still remains very powerful, and even some of the more recent Gallup polls have showed that local news was the main source among the television news sources. So, I think it is very consistent with what we know about people's media diet. We know they spend a lot of time in front of screens, whether it's computer screens or television screens or even GPS screens. So it doesn't surprise me that television remains dominant.
Has television always been dominant?
Well, it's been dominant since the late 1950s. It became the dominant both news medium, but certainly the dominant mass medium in the late 50s, and has basically held sway through the modern era. The rise of the internet, I think, has been dramatic because of how sharply it's risen and been adopted. What we do see is that the internet is rising at a sharper rate, even if television remains dominant. We see even some slight declines in television.
It's interesting, this poll found that 55% of the people use TV as their main news source. Only 21% of them use the internet. But that's when you look at sort of all age demographics. And I'm wondering how that breaks down in age groups, because there's a graph included in the report. The older you get, the higher that TV number goes.
Well, that's right. And one of there's a few things we know about differences by generation in terms of use of different media. We know that some of the most powerful effects of mass media tend to be centered on the medium that you grew up with. So for the civic generation, it tends to be centered around newspapers, for boomers around television, and for Generation X and younger, the internet tends to be the most powerful medium in terms of both knowledge gain and in terms of activating people into being more active in politics and civic life. But at the same time, I think it's interesting to note that among those younger generations, we're seeing the most dominant use of the internet, while we're seeing flagging use among the most old, partly because that generation is passing away.
And let's talk about some of those other sources that we've been focusing mostly on TV and the internet. But print is still out there in one form or another, and we're on the radio, and radio is out there too.
Well, and what's interesting, I think, about this poll as well, when they break it down and you look at the relationship to education, what you find is those audiences, especially for print media and newspapers, but also to some degree for radio, tend to be the more educated audiences, right? So college graduates and postgraduate numbers among that group of users was very high, those who preferred radio and television. Now, the other interesting thing about this particular poll is the way they asked the question, which was just a open-ended question, so people could just kind of say, name a possible television source or a possible radio source. When we look at this in terms of how often do people use a particular medium for getting the news, what we find is about 20% of the public on a daily basis gets news from the radio.
That's still pretty impressive. Is there any indication of how often people cross over and use radio and television, or television and the internet, or do people sort of focus with one medium that they like and stay there?
Well, what we do know is a couple things about that. We know that the tendency now is to be using multiple media devices simultaneously. And so when there are these studies of screen time or media diaries where they keep track of who's using media at a particular point in time, what they find is people are often, you know, they have the radio on in the background, but they may be reading something at the same time. We are often in situations where we're exposed to multiple media simultaneously, and we're seeing a lot of this with digital media appliances where we'll be watching television, but also be on the internet, also be tweeting about it. And we see this during, say, presidential debates, for example.
Now, what about mobile devices? Did they factor into this?
When you do, in the screen time studies, you see more and more time with mobile devices, especially among the youngest generations. I don't think this particular study, based on the way they asked the question, it's kind of hard to tease out when people might be getting their news through a mobile device. So, for example, if I'm watching ABC News online through my smartphone, am I answering television or am I answering internet? If I'm listening to an NPR podcast on my iPod, what do I count that as? So, again, the way the questions get asked, sometimes doesn't reveal as much as we might want to know about how this is being used.
What do we know about who's watching television? Is it clumped among a particular demographic, or are we looking at sort of an across-the-board phenomenon?
Well, it's the most popular medium based on the way this question was asked across all of the different age groups, though decidedly more popular among the oldest. So if you compare, between those 18 and 29, it's about 50%, but you get up to the 65 and older, and 68% of that particular demographic group is relying on television as their primary source. Now, when you kind of relate that to educational levels, what you find is television is the most dominant source among the least educated, 61%. When you get into the postgraduate group, it's actually down to 43%. It's still the most popular among the name media, but not even being used by a majority of that particular demographic category.
And at the same time, and we've been reading a lot about this lately, television in particular seems to have splintered into more partisan forms. There's the Fox News watchers, the folks who watch CNN or MSNBC, and that... How does that shake out in all of this? I mean, TV has had to change, I think, in order to attract audiences. And I think a lot of people will argue that one of the way they've had to change is to appeal to a certain constituency.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And if you look at the cable news networks, Gallup has been asking a question basically from the mid-90s forward about, do you every day, several days a week, occasionally rely on a particular news source for the news? And what you see with cable news has risen dramatically. It's gone from about 20%, and actually right before, in the late 90s, it was down to 16%. Suddenly, it jumped up dramatically post 9/11, and it stayed there. Really about, 40% of the public relying on cable news as one of their sources on a daily basis.
And who comes up on the top of that cable news heap?
Well, it's Fox News, which is has been the case for quite some time, though Fox has seen some deterioration in its ratings. But again, they've been among the cable news sources between CNN, MSNBC, and some of the financial channels. Fox has definitely been the most popular of the choices.
And that focus on local news that you mentioned earlier, that's so interesting because that keeps coming up over time. I mean, that attraction to your local station has been there for a long time.
Well, and I think that's even more true with the decline of the local newspaper. So what we see is, I think there's obviously still a very strong appetite for local news, though we've seen a dramatic drink from the mid late 90s even to within a 10-year period, almost 10% drop in people's reading of local newspapers. But what we see during that same period is some rise in national newspaper use, people going to the USA Today's, the New York Times, but then also that preference for those local news programs that are being broadcast, and I think radio fills that role as well.
And we have to leave it there. We're talking to Devon Shaw, professor of communication and political science at UW-Madison, talking about the preference for TV news over all other sources. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm here with Jean Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell, filling in for Rob Ferret this week.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about a new Gallup poll showing that Americans go to their televisions first for news. UW-Madison communications and political science professor Devon Shaw is here to help us break down our news habits. And we'd love to know, what are your news habits? Are you going to television like most of the people responded in this poll? Or are you going somewhere else? And why? If you're going to television, why do you go to TV over other sources like, say, radio, for instance, or newspaper or the Internet? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Devon, what about localism when it comes to news? If people are going to television, are they going to those local news shows because they want to know what's happening where they are, where they live?
Well, I think they're going to a variety of sources within the television environment. And one that we know is still very strong is those local news programs. In a Gallup poll that was just done a few years ago, local news was still seen by 51% of the respondents every day. There's probably been some decline in the few years since this poll, but I think it's still important to remember there's a huge audience for that local content. And again, especially with the decline of local newspapers, I think that's something that people do tend to go to television for. Now, they're also going to it for those cable news sources and that more opinionated news that I think is also filling a particular niche.
Now, as you take a look at these surveys, it's what can you draw from this? Like, if you're looking at civic engagement, for example, and we know that most people still use television as a main source of news, does that mean anything? Should we take anything away from that?
Well, what's interesting is there's a huge distinction and difference between what I would call dosage and potency, and I think that's the medical analogy works well, because you can think about a large dose of a medicine that isn't very potent, doesn't have a very good effect, maybe a degraded drug that came from overseas. But television is kind of the same thing. It tends to be one of the more dominant medium that are used for consuming news. At the same time, its impact compared to print news sources, compared to the Internet, is fairly minuscule. Most of the studies looking at the effects of broadcast content find only public media, things like public radio and public television, tending to have the more pro-social effects, some news content, but even then much more limited compared to what we see in terms of the effects of newspaper reading, the effects of use of the Internet for gathering and sharing news.
So let me ask a question. Why does that matter?
Well, I think it matters because with newspapers in particular, with the tremendous decline we're seeing in newspaper readership, and yes, the Internet's picking up some of that, but I think with the Internet we're getting something similar to what we get with cable news, which is more opinionated news sources and an opportunity for what we might call the echo chamber, right? The opportunity to see and have our own opinions reinforced. So those places where we encountered cross-cutting opinion, I think, is being cut down. Television news, again, it's not just that it's the most popular medium. I also think a lot of television news content, studies have shown, tends to focus on less in-depth coverage, tends to focus on the most dramatic content, the most visually appealing content, and maybe not the content that is the most pressing from a policy standpoint or in terms of the pressing problems facing a country.
Now, we have a comment on Facebook from Jennifer, who says that she gets 98% of her news from the internet. There's one voice for you. And let's go next to Steve, who's joining us from Comstock. Hey, Steve.
Oh. Yeah, I get most of my news from the internet. I find the American television sources are very biased. I can't believe anyone would watch Fox after the FCC downgraded them to satire. But I also, when I get my internet news, I like to get it from, like, the BBC or Al Jazeera, or say if there's a story happening somewhere, find an English translation of the local newspaper, and, you know, get a different perspective. And I find that way I get more of a rounded view of the news.
A little more digesting to do, Steve. Is that worth it?
Yes, it is. You have to be informed nowadays. There's just too much going on. It's irresponsible not to be informed, in my opinion.
And that's an interesting point. You know, Steve is willing to do the work to digest himself and kind of make sense of all his different sources that he's going to. For television, is it more one-stop shopping for people?
Well, it might seem like one-stop shopping, but I think your caller is doing some really important work. He's doing, you know, that searching across various sources, trying to decide based on looking across those sources what you believe to be the truth. I think looking at both U.S. and foreign news sources is really important, looking at various prestige media. I think that's something we're not getting when we just rely on television. I think the kind of work that your caller was doing is something that only a small subset of media users do, but the internet certainly allows, and I think what we're seeing is for a certain subgroup of the more news-hungry, the opportunity to really inform yourself.
You know, taking a look at television news, it's hard to imagine if you would have, you know, been around 30 years ago, it would be hard to imagine what today's media landscape looks like. And, you know, as you look ahead, maybe 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, at the pace at which things are going, is TV still going to be the dominant medium in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? Is there any way to predict that?
Well, I think what's interesting is we're seeing the convergence of various media spaces into one, right? So I think with something like television, we'll be talking about networks in the same way that we're talking about them now, or a nightly news broadcast. I think it's hard to know. I think what we'll see is a lot of people nowadays even consume what we would call television through their computers. Increasingly, televisions are computers and have computer capabilities, including the ability to go into social network spaces like Facebook and YouTube. And so I think these venues are converging. Will there be some kind of medium where broadcast images of some sort are shared and where there's an opportunity to kind of see up-to-date real-time events? I'm sure that will still exist in some form. But I think, again, we're going to see tremendous convergence between social media, digital media, and what we consider broadcast media right now.
And that, it seems to me, is going to require some tremendous flexibility, some big investments on the part of television networks, and all those. That convergence comes with a price.
Well, I think that's right. And I think one of the things that we're seeing is certainly some of the traditional networks' willingness to invest in that, especially in their news divisions, has been somewhat, you know, limited. So what we're seeing is if there is an investment, they're really not making it in terms of expanding those capabilities. It is something that I think we're seeing happening much more just from the grassroots, a lot of people creating content, sharing content. So when we talk about the social media space, we're also talking about a lot of user-created content. And it's interesting to see among the younger generation how much more people are going to places like YouTube and Twitter, not just as social media sources, but even as news sources.
But then that brings up the whole question of what is journalism? How do you define that? Is it as simple as somebody pointing a camera at a fire, for example, and publishing it on YouTube?
Well, and I have two colleagues in my department you guys should be interviewing about that very question, Sue Robinson and Lucas Graves, who are actually studying that very question. And, you know, it is a fascinating question. I think there is a certain democratization in terms of the ability to share information and the ability to, quote-unquote, broadcast yourself, which is what YouTube is saying it's allowing people to do. At the same time, there's tremendous evidence that we still do, as I think the poll that you just shared illustrates, tend to rely on certain dominant media sources for our news. So we are seeing that democratization. We're seeing that ability to kind of filter and sift through for the most dedicated users, but it's limited. It's not being done by everybody.
Well, Devon, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
That was Devon Shaw, professor of communication and political science at UW-Madison.
Coming up next on Central Time, we'll be talking about the Wisconsin Innovations Exhibit at the Wisconsin Historical Society. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. And a long-standing exhibit at the Wisconsin Historical Society is getting ready to pack it up.
Come August 3rd, Wisconsin Innovations is making way for something new, but the exhibit is a mind-bender for Wisconsin history lovers. So we thought we'd take a look at it today and highlight some of the cool Wisconsin-born stuff that it celebrates.
In fact, we're joined now by Joseph Kapler, curator at the Wisconsin Historical Museum. Joseph, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
I'd like to start with a little bit of background on this because, as I understand it, the exhibit's been up for a while. But what was the idea behind it? You know, I've lived in Wisconsin my whole life, and I think of cheese, I think, you know, all the usual things. But Wisconsin, boy, you think about this exhibit, we got a lot going on.
Yeah, we kind of reacted to those basic top-of-mind things that you think of about Wisconsin. And obviously, there's more to the story. It's a greater depth. And reviewing those kind of top lists of Wisconsin inventions, I think there's a poster kicking around there. We thought, yeah, there's some great stories here, but there's more. And we learned a lot more in the process of the research and the development. The lead curator, Dave Driscoll, spent a good year in prep time hunting and gathering stories. And then in the museum format, you primarily use things, artifacts, real things, as the jumping off point to tell those stories. Finding real things for early or inventions is very, very hard to do. So with his good work and a lot of help from lenders, individuals, businesses, and other museums around the state and actually around the country, we're able to pull together 40 to 50 of these kind of wonderful stories of inventions or ideas or traditions that originated one way or another in Wisconsin.
So in terms of Wisconsin's history, when did that spirit of innovation, that sort of entrepreneurship, when did that start? And any theories as to why it happened here as opposed to somewhere else?
One of the earliest examples in the show is Increase Lapham. And for listeners who, you know, who might be heard that name here or there, Lapham was involved in so many things, kind of a geologist, an historian, and a scientist. And kind of one of those early examples of people out here on the frontier, out in the sticks, and he was, you know, just one of these great minds, and you could do a whole exhibition on Increase Lapham, and he's out of Milwaukee in the 1830s and 1840s, and stayed his life in Wisconsin, and what we chose to kind of focus on is something, an idea of his that affects everybody's lives today, and that's the idea of forecasting storms, a national weather service. If I could take a minute to kind of tell that story. 1869, a catastrophic storm on Lake Michigan, great loss of life and property. And it was his idea to put together things already out there in place. That is a network of telegraph systems and his amateur scientific measurements and studies and things. Weather pretty much moves west to east, and you can probably forecast what's coming. So on display, we have one of his charts that he did showing meteorological measurements in Dubuque, Iowa, generally westerly of Milwaukee. And then hours later, here are readings in Milwaukee, and they pretty much parallel. This proves that you can look westward and have an idea of what's coming over the horizon. And putting that together and getting the right politicians to get this through, to get the U.S. Army Signal Corps to essentially establish a network of forecasting information forward, protecting weather. Fast forward, eventually a National Weather Service is formed, and he is the first administrator, if you will, in the Great Lakes region. He issued the first storm warning for the Great Lakes region. Kind of fitting. So that's one of those little things We take that for granted today. You tune in. Whoever thinks they're going to get caught out, unless you're out on the boat and you don't have the radio on, especially in the information age. Extremely important. Kind of one of those unexpected things coming from Wisconsin.
And so it started early here, and then it continued, of course, to the 19th and 20th and 21st centuries. We've got a couple of thoughts from listeners who are writing in on Facebook. James says, new glarus spotted cow. Okay, I'm not sure if that counts. Brandy old-fashioned. But Scott says, Les Paul guitars, and lest we forget about the Wizard of Waukesha. And the Les Paul, of course, is still one of the great guitars that is played today everywhere. And you look at it on every rock stage anywhere in the world. And it all started here in Wisconsin.
And certainly Les Paul is one of those have-to-have stories in the exhibition. And not only the solid-body electric guitar, but also multi-track recording. There probably isn't a song in popular music in the last 50 years that doesn't somehow owe a debt of gratitude to the Wizard of Waukesha. Most of his major important innovations were done elsewhere, Los Angeles and the East Coast and New York, obviously in the recording industries. But his story is about identity. It's great stuff. We love him. He's the Wizard of Waukesha. Most people know that Les Paul is from Wisconsin. The unexpected people out there with similar stories is Tom Blake. Any idea
Help
who
me.
Tom
Help me. I have no idea who Tom Blake is.
Generally considered one of the two most important people in modern surfing.
Okay, besides Dick Dale, there's one. Who else? What did Tom Blake do?
Tom Blake invented essentially the modern surfboard, the hollow core surfboard, about 1926. Similar story. Grew up in the Milwaukee area. Swimmer. Eventually moved away as a young man to Los Angeles. Took up surfing. Moved to Hawaii. He was very naturally adept and skilled at it. But he also had a great mind. And so you take this big, heavy longboard that so few people can actually use. And he took essentially airplane wing technology and made a very light yet robust and durable form of a board that many people could use. He also did the keel, for amateurs to be able to operate a surfboard, the underwater camera housing to get those great photos looking up at someone hanging 10 and the curl coming over. He made surfing popular to a mass audience. And then, unlike Les Paul, he came back here, retired, and is buried up in Washburn overlooking Lake Superior. You know, that's coming full circle. You could argue he's more Wisconsinite than a Les Paul. Certainly great stories. So we kind of look at identity there.
And you talked about the surfing. The Les Paul, of course, we still have his first guitar, I think. But what about the first surfboard? Is that one of those artifacts that was tough to find?
Yeah, the Alpha artifacts are almost impossible to find. There is one example in the state, and if we have time, I can share
sure.
that later. But the early Blake boards are around. I mean, a lot of these get beat up, broken over rocks, I'm
sure,
tossed.
They got used, right? I mean, they weren't built this day in museums.
Sure. Split up, thrown on bonfires, I'm sure,
okay.
as well. But those early Tom Blake marked boards, they have on the drain piece is a brass piece, and it has a Tom Blake mark. Those are extremely rare and very collectible. One of those exists in Wisconsin, and the good folks at Washburn County Historical Museum lent that piece to us, one of their very great pieces, to get it down here to this show and expose it and its story to a bigger audience.
Elsewhere, we often think of Wisconsin, of course, in terms of dairy products and beer, vitamin D enriched milk. I always thought that was – I thought milk came with vitamin D. You know, I mean, what do I know, apparently?
Certainly, vitamin studies, hugely important in UW, University of Wisconsin-Madison's history with kind of the agricultural nutrient studies going on. So its discovery here on campus and others led to the practical applications of the benefits of vitamin D in milk and other items. A great object in the show, which closes August 3rd, is a Schlitz beer can. What does that have to do with vitamin D? Well, it was infused with vitamin D, 1936. So It's this highly collectible can. We had a hunt and search for it. So here it is, 1936. It's one of the first cans to be first metal cans when they went from bottle glass bottles to metal. And Schlitz was an early company, an early brand to do that. And then here it has infused with sunshine, vitamin D, and its advertising, which we include in the exhibition. It's just fantastic. You know, enjoy that summer glow by drinking Schlitz beer. It's that over the top. This is just a wonderful kind of artifact with three, you know, really important Wisconsin stories packed into this, you know, 7-inch high metal can.
And of course, Wisconsin's got that great industrial heritage. So, you know, we were manufacturing cars and auto parts and all sorts of machinery. The first typewriter with the standard QWERTY keyboard. That's a Wisconsin thing.
You can blame Christopher Scholes if you don't like the QWERTY logic, but his thinking there was to keep the most often used keys separate because the mechanical keys hung
up
together.
It's interesting, and I don't blame him for anything, and I'm too old to learn another form of typing right now, so I'm good with that. Is there any artifact, anything that you are really missing that would have been great to have as part of this exhibit that you tried and tried and tried and just couldn't lay your hands on?
You know, we would love to have had the appeal of, let's say, you know, a Les Paul guitar. We do have a Les Paul, a very nice piece, but say one used by Steve Miller, his godson. So Steve Miller used Les Paul, a couple layers of Wisconsin, you know, cultural history there. Those are hard to find. And we'd like to mention that the Waukesha County Museum has a great Les Paul exhibition opened about a month ago, and they were able to acquire some great Les Paul pieces recently, and that's a nice exhibition to check out.
So tell me about the reception that you've got. How long has the exhibit been up?
2 years.
Okay.
Longer than typical, probably for a changing exhibition. But obviously, there's lots of history and culture in there, a lot of great stories, works well with school groups, which is a huge part of our audience. And so we were able to incorporate more stories. Some things had to be rotated out, returned on return, such as the Blake surfboard. And other things, we just had more stories than we could fit in the space. So we were able to kind of keep it fresh over 2 years. And we're even actually updating it this Friday, keeping it going for even just the remaining 3 weeks.
So the remaining 3 weeks, you know, and I know things have to change and you have to get a new exhibit up. Still, it's going to be sad to see it go.
Some of those things, it is, because we borrowed a lot of them, but we're able to share those with our audiences. They're both Wisconsinites and visitors from around the country and around the world. You know, but we maintain relationships with lenders. And, you know, who knows, another day, another show, perhaps someday these things could be maybe come into the permanent collection to be used and shared by all in perpetuity. So it's never really a goodbye.
It's never really a goodbye. And what do you got planned for that space?
We're going to do a little renovation up there this summer with some of the physical walls and spaces. We're going to update and make it a little bit bigger and give us a little bit more flexibility for upcoming shows and exhibitions. And we're exploring a couple of those concepts right now, or actually more than concepts, when we're working through that. And I'll be back here I'd be happy to be back here and talk about those exhibitions later this fall.
And we'll look forward to that. Joseph, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Joseph Kapler is a curator at the Wisconsin Historical Museum, and he's been talking with us about the Wisconsin Innovations Exhibit. And that closes on August 3rd.
Coming up, bikes are booming in Wisconsin and across the country. We'll find out why more of us are using pedal power and what it means for sharing the road. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. In this week for Rob Ferret, you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.